From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the final days of his presidency, Republican President Dwight Eisenhower delivered a farewell address to the nation. Not all presidents give such a speech, but Eisenhower had something he wanted to say. He talked about a number of things, but what most remember is his warning about the country being too dependent on the military and the structure that supported it. He called it the military-industrial complex, and the idea and the term has stuck. Today in the program, we're talking about this speech, breaking it down with the journalist James Ledbetter. Ledbetter says it may be an older speech, but it's a mistake to think of it in the past tense. He says it still reveals our conflicted feelings about the relationship between democracy and military strength, and he says it continues to shape the country's political landscape. So join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On January 17, 1961, with just days left in his presidency, Dwight Eisenhower gave a farewell address to the nation. Now, for all the things he was known for, giving speeches wasn't one of them. He was uncomfortable with the new medium of television. He was still dealing with the effects of a stroke, which had affected the way he spoke. And it wasn't as though he had to give such a speech. There was no mandate for it in the Constitution, no protocol requiring it. But Eisenhower had something he wanted to say. And it wasn't just one thing. He had a few things on his mind, and he was determined to say them.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. First, I should like to express my gratitude to the radio and television networks for the opportunities they have given me over the years to bring reports and messages to our nation. My special thanks go to them for the opportunity of addressing you this evening. 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen.
Now, contained in the address was one remarkable sentence about what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. It was his term for an idea that had been bothering him, that the country was becoming too dependent on the military and the structure that supported it. Well, today in the program, we're talking about that speech. We're breaking it down with the journalist James Ledbetter. Ledbetter says that this idea still reveals our complicated feelings about that relationship between democracy and military strength, and the speech continues to shape the way we think about the country's political landscape today. Ledbetter has written a book which is called Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex, and he's joining us to talk about it. James Ledbetter is the editor of Reuters.com, among other books. He's written The Great Depression, A Diary, and he's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City today. And James Ledbetter, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
I wanted to begin by getting a sense of when it is you started paying attention to the Eisenhower speech, and what is it that you wanted to say about it? Because it's interesting, you mentioned in the book that you're not as interested in the debate as much about the idea contained in the speech itself and sort of how it evolved, how it came to be.
I think that the idea of writing this book occurred to me a few years ago when I started to think about the what was the legacy of the American New Left of the late 1960s and early 1970s. And so many of the more extreme positions we associate with that have either been discredited or gone out of fashion. And just trying to think of what were the enduring ideas, what were the positive things to the national debate that the New Left had to offer. And as I kind of went down the list, I think a very important component of the anti-Vietnam War movement was to draw attention to this idea of a military-industrial complex, yeah. And that whether the people who were shouting in the streets or on university campuses in the late 1960s and early 1970s were aware of Eisenhower's coinage of this phrase, the idea that there was this kind of uncontrollable beast that either, you know, depending on who you were listening to, either started the war or prolonged the war or was profiting off the war or all of those in some combination, and that that same beast carries an undue, unwarranted power in Congress, that that idea had originated with Eisenhower and taken root in the culture, and that that at some point between, say, the $600 toilet seat scandals of the 1980s and the fall of the Soviet Union in the late 80s, early 90s, that we'd kind of gotten away from this idea of the military-industrial complex. People had stopped talking about it until the Iraq War, and the fact that we were in Iraq for a lot longer than I think was originally planned, the fact that war costs a lot more money, than the rise of things like the Blackwater scandal and the Abu Ghraib prison torture stories, that this brought the idea back in some very concrete ways.
In the book, you talk about the speech having a kind of historical elasticity. What do you mean by that? That it sort of becomes misinterpreted, maybe even overstated at time? Because you talk about how it's become this kind of icon, and there's some sense of whether we understood it in the context of its time. We don't really have a full understanding of exactly what he meant. Talk about what you mean by the elasticity of the speech.
Sure. The elasticity, by the way, goes in both temporal directions.
Sure, sure.
So that if you think of the speech itself on January 17th, 1961 as the center, and you think about kind of pulling toward the past, I think one of the reasons why the speech has been so enduring, one of the reasons that we're talking about it half a century later, is that it tapped into and kind of reformulated some already existing ideas out there about the relationship between military political power and the private sector. Particularly in the 1930s, there was a kind of very large movement in public opinion around the idea of merchants of death. Mm-hmm. The idea here was that during World War One, remember the U.S. didn't get into World War One till toward the end of that conflict, and was kind of brought in despite the fact that the official policy of the country for many years had been neutrality. And so there was a kind of rush to build arms, to draft troops, to kind of get the country on a war footing in a very short period of time. And as a consequence, I think everyone agreed in the 1930s that there had been price gouging, there had been shoddy materiel, and what began to emerge in the 1930s was this notion that the United States had actually been pushed into World War One, by arms manufacturers themselves, and not just in the United States, but people who were selling, as it were, arms to all sides, right? So you had people who were selling arms to the Germans, and people who were selling ships to the French, and people who were selling, whatever to the United States, and that somehow this had, again, either tipped the scale for the U.S. to participate in that war, or drawn it out, or allowed some people to profit at cost to everyone else. This notion had a lot of political power in the 1930s, and I'm able to demonstrate in the book that Eisenhower was intimately familiar with the critique. Now, I can't say that he agreed with it.
Sure, sure.
I don't have any real documentation of that. He had to officially kind of put on a certain kind of neutrality, because in the late 1920s, early 1930s, Eisenhower was working as a bureaucrat in the Department of War. They were trying to figure out how to rationalize the process of arming the country in cases of war. You know, this is one of the points that Eisenhower returns to in the farewell speech. traditionally in the United States, up until World War II, when we had to go to war, we built weapons. Right. We drafted armies. When we were at peace, which, you know, was a lot of the time, we didn't have much of a standing army. We didn't. There was no such thing as an air force in the old days. We had a, you know, enough of a navy to get us by. But when the United States entered World War I, I think we had an army about the size of Bulgaria's. I mean, it was really quite small. And so this accordion-like nature of the military is what had dominated American life up until World War II. After that, we have more of what you would think of as a permanent war industry. Huge standing army, largest in the world, certainly with most the highest levels of capability, best technology. Then, of course, the development of nuclear weapons and all of the bureaucracy around that, plus the secret labs. And you begin to see how that idea mushrooms out. So that's kind of where things stood when Eisenhower gave the speech. And then you talk about that elasticity into the future. Then it brings in the critique of the Vietnam War. Then it brings in something that is very powerful today, but that was not around during Eisenhower's time, the United States as an arms merchant abroad. We are now by far the largest arms merchant in the world, you know, an industry that didn't exist when Eisenhower was president. I'm not that much of a stickler about, you know, has the public misinterpreted the phrase military-industrial complex to mean something other than what Eisenhower meant? I don't have an answer for that, and yeah. On some level, I don't really care. Yeah. The more important questions to me are: to what extent can we determine what he did mean,
right.
And then what does it mean that the concept has embraced all of these other critiques both before and after the speech was given?
Well, you talk about how we imbue it with our own kind of meaning. You know, the meaning that aligns with our own views. It's kind of a Rorschach blot. You talk about
absolutely. And you know, one of the things that's interesting is that the phrase military-industrial complex is, I think, one of the most honored presidential phrases of the modern period, right? You can read the paper on any given day. My friend Peggy Ornstein has a book out now about little girls' obsessions with being a princess, and somebody in review called it the princess industrial complex, because there's all these, like, you know, pink wands, and people talk about a prison industrial complex, yeah. A pharmaceutical industrial complex. And the funny thing about that is, depending on your definition, we're kind of just barely an industrial society at all anymore. You know, most of the level of manufacturing as a percentage of jobs in the United States is at an all-time low since they started keeping records. We are a post-industrial society, but yet that phrase is still so potent that you see it kind of coined everywhere. And so that's one level of meaning that we imbue to it. You know, another level is it a constructive concept to think about a complex that is more powerful than, say, the President of the United States and the Congress? So if you accept this critique, you accept the idea that the money that flows through the, you know, from the Pentagon because of Congress into local jobs to build stuff and then back to Congress in the form of campaign contributions, etc. If you accept that idea as this all-encompassing beast, is that a useful construct, or is that kind of a cop-out? You know, do we talk about a military-industrial complex being in charge because we're afraid to step up to the plate and say, well, actually, we don't want to spend this kind of money on the military. We don't want to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, there's some degree to which our attachment to the phrase might itself be unhealthy.
Mm. I want to play an excerpt from the speech. In fact, if we have time, I wanted to get to a few excerpts. This is the longest section that I want to play, and this is the part of the speech that contains the term military-industrial complex. Not much to say in terms of setting it up, but James Ledbetter, I wanted to get your sense of what the difference between hearing Eisenhower deliver it and seeing it on the page. I think it makes a bit of a difference. He's not a great orator, but it's interesting to hear him actually say it himself.
It is very interesting. If you watch the speech on YouTube in its entirety, you definitely have a sense of portions of it that he was more comfortable with as opposed to others, and kind of places where he's clearly, you know, like reading from the script because it seems fairly new to him. Of course, it wasn't. It gone through something like two dozen drafts, but there are places where he's just more comfortable with the text, and I think that this portion of the speech, he's pretty engaged.
A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
James Ledbetter, you know what strikes me is among other things, and we'll talk about a lot of the particulars here, but the term spiritual,
yeah,
which comes up again in the speech. What do you think he's getting at there?
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I think it is one of the most difficult aspects of this speech to grapple with. And I guess I would say, too, that because the word spiritual is so broad, so subject to different interpretations, it's probably one that could never really be settled definitively to all parties. But my view of it, based largely on Eisenhower's other writings and Eisenhower's comments, particularly in the second half of his presidency, is that he was genuinely concerned about the structure of society that allowed for liberty and individualism to grow the way that Americans think they are supposed to, and that if we were to allow a military-industrial complex, or frankly any kind of martial authority, to gain too much power, too much control over the society, that it would have an effect on the way we feel about ourselves, the way that we perceive our roles in the world and our roles in society. And that is I think a profound psychological observation for a president to make, because what it is saying is that the idea of peacetime is more than simply not being at war, or perhaps even more than winning a war, winning a Cold War. It's actually a state of mind. It's a state of, you know, talk about national security. Do we feel secure? Are we constantly in a state of paranoia, constantly in a state of kind of, you know, on the edge of war or halfway in wars, which I think you could argue has been largely the case since the end of World War II in the United States. And it's a place where if you really want to kind of expand out of this idea of spiritual, you could certainly argue that the military-industrial complex won.
Mm. You know, I was thinking also, because you write about this, you give us a sense of who Eisenhower was, like where he's coming from. And you talk about one of those ironies, of course, in terms of his personal life, his upbringing and his life experience, which had to have informed the way he was thinking about all of this. And one of those, of course, is the fact that he is the son of pacifist Mennonites. And you talk about how his upbringing, which was fairly restrictive, is really pious, you know, no alcohol or smoking or swearing or playing cards. You say it didn't leave Eisenhower with an antipathy for war necessarily, but it did give him a kind of nuanced sense of warfare. So when he says spiritual, it seems like that it's packed with that kind of sensibility as well. Do you think?
I think that's right, and I think that his youth definitely shaped his character, and then of course his experience during World War II. Remember the largest armed conflict, you know, of its kind in the history of mankind. He was in charge of the largest multinational force in the history of mankind in order to defeat an enemy of democracy, and so he really did perceive these things in spiritual terms. And one of the great fears that he had, and many others, was this idea of a garrison state. Again, the notion that if you want to win a war against an enemy that you believe will kind of spare no expense and spare no, will stop at nothing to crack down on things like civil rights, human rights, political parties, democratic expression, freedom of the press, et cetera, you could mobilize your entire society into a war footing for all time. But if you did that, Eisenhower believed, you would kind of kill democracy in order to save it. You would create this thing that he was very afraid of, the garrison state, a Pyrrhic victory of the First Order. So the question is, at what point do you have to stop and put a check and a balance on military power and military authority in order to prevent that overreach of the military, while still, of course, as he said in the portion of the speech that you just played, have sufficient strength in order to protect American democracy from its enemies without.
James Ledbetter is with us. His book is called Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're breaking down an old speech. It was the farewell address given by President Dwight Eisenhower in the final days of his presidency. And in it, he warns about the dangers of the country becoming too dependent on the military and that structure that was built around it. He famously called it the military-industrial complex. The journalist James Ledbetter is our guest to take us through the speech. He's written a book. It's called Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. Let's go to the phones. Tom is with us in Reston, Virginia. Tom, welcome.
Hello, Doug.
Hi.
Well, I just had a comment. I heard a show talking about this speech a year or so ago, and I remember the speaker saying that the word congressional had also been in an earlier draft of that speech, but was taken out of that particular phrase. And I wonder what his comment would be on that.
So that it was military, congressional, industrial complex, something like that?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, James Ledbetter, you write about that. What do you just remember that?
Yeah, this is one of those little myths that won't quite die. I've looked at every extant draft of the speech. I double checked this with the Eisenhower Library after some new drafts were discovered just back in December, and there is no version of the phrase military-industrial complex that exists in any other draft. There's another very closely related myth that says that it was military-industrial-scientific complex. It's hard to say. I mean, I think I've kind of traced these canards to their roots, and it usually starts with it starts with sloppy scholarship, and then it gets kind of picked up by people. You know, is it possible that someone at some point in the drafting or discussions around the speech had that idea? Yes, of course. Is there any documentary evidence that the phrase existed in any other form? There is not. And it's sort of impossible to believe that you could... I should add there the one of the earliest documents that exists that talks about the topic of this speech. Keep in mind, Eisenhower didn't write the speech himself. It was presented to him by two speechwriters, Malcolm Moose and Ralph Williams, very much in Eisenhower's voice and using ideas that were close to his heart. Otherwise, he would never have delivered the speech if he didn't believe in it. And by that time, he'd already worked on it for a couple of months. But there's a document from late October of 1960 that uses the phrase war-based industrial complex. That seems to be the first version of the phrase. And then by the time the first draft that we have that exists of the speech, it's military-industrial complex. So if you think about it, the notion that it would have changed to military-industrial-scientific or military-industrial-congressional and then changed back without leaving any trace is pretty hard to accept. So let's just say... with regard to Tom's comment, they were definitely thinking about Congress. They were definitely thinking about Congress's role in perpetuating this military-industrial complex. But at no point did they actually include congressional in the phrase, as far as the historical documents indicate.
Mm. Tom, we're glad you called. Thanks very much. You know, it's interesting. I'm trying to decide whether to play this excerpt. It's about 2 minutes, and the reason I want to play it is because it contains the word balance in it time and time and time and time again. And you write about this idea of balance. In some ways, was critical to the way Eisenhower thought about the way he managed the war as the Supreme Commander, about the way he thought about the world in general. Talk a little bit about that, because balance is an important way of understanding how Eisenhower thought.
Very important. Among Eisenhower historians, the notion of balance is a truism bordering on a cliche. Everything he did, he believed in balance. So many of the speeches, including this one, talk about the need to maintain a balance or restore a balance, strike a balance.
Yeah.
My sense is that one of the reasons this speech exists in the first place is Eisenhower's personal sense that the balance that we had once struck had fallen out of whack, and he didn't know how to get it back. And I think that the primary events that were responsible for that took place in the fall of 1957. The first was the launch of the Sputnik satellite, which caught a lot of people in the United States and Congress off guard. It certainly looked as if we were kind of now suddenly behind the Soviet Union in terms of our technological capabilities, and it didn't take a lot of projection into the future to think, well, if they can put a satellite into space, they can probably also attach something nuclear to something in space, and then you're looking at a very different game. So the cries that came from Congress and in cahoots with the military, particularly the Air Force, to spend more to kind of meet the Sputnik threat were very, very loud. And I think Eisenhower and certainly some of the people around him, but Eisenhower in particular, were not entirely prepared for that. And then almost simultaneously, and it's hard to believe there's no connection between these two things, a long-ordered report known informally as the Gaither Report, which was supposed to be confidential, was leaked to the public, and it purported to show that the United States nuclear arsenal was already behind or was soon to fall behind that of the Soviet Union. That the warheads that they'd been amassing, they were amassing more quickly, even though we started, we were the first to develop nuclear weapons. We started with a great advantage, but that they had caught up in a hurry and, we were falling behind if we weren't already behind. And this is the origin of the phrase missile gap, on which the 1960 presidential election partially was fought with the Democrats in particular saying we needed to spend more money to close this missile gap. The frustration that Eisenhower felt about that is that he knew that the numbers were wrong. We had, by that time, very good intelligence from the U-2 spy planes, but of course they were completely confidential. The very existence of the U-2 spy plane was confidential, so you couldn't sort of turn around and say, "Well, actually, no." But how do you fight against a public that is crying for more military spending, a military that says we're falling behind, and these sort of documents? And I think that in that frustration, you see the beginnings of the critique of a military-industrial complex, that they are the profit motive from people who want to build more weapons, the political hay to be made for clamoring for them, regardless of actual military need. That's the kind of thing that drove Eisenhower bonkers, because it messed completely with his idea of balance. And I think that the farewell address, although it makes use of the concept of balance, is an instance where Eisenhower was trying to signal to people that the balance had fallen.
Here's an email from Dan, who writes from Brigham City, Utah. He writes, "I think the best evidence that Dwight Eisenhower was right is that in a time of draconian cuts being proposed to the federal budget, the defense budget is pretty much off limits. Surely we can afford, and Dan writes, need to cut the world's largest defense budget, but it is never even considered, or the cuts, if they do come, are more symbolic than real." So I guess this conversation, as you say, this is still a modern conversation. We're still talking about these kinds of things. And the
Absolutely.
Context for now seems incredibly apt. Talk about Dan's comment.
Sure.
If you would.
In the first portion of the second portion of the speech that you played, Eisenhower talks about we have to have this big military, right? We're not going to go back anytime soon to the swords into plowshares into swords economy. He said we have been compelled to create the modern military. And listening to it again, I was thinking, yeah, okay, compelled by what, though? Compelled by a communist threat that today doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So what's compelling us today? So we'll leave that to one side. I think the thrust of what Dan is saying is something that I agree with and is one of the reasons why I wrote this book. I think, though, we are beginning to hear, at least on the fringes of congressional debate, a little bit more of the sensibility that if we're going to be making big nasty cuts to entitlement programs, then everything needs to be on the table, and that the military is a place where you could at least in theory make cuts that would not directly hurt individuals the way that, say, cutting Social Security or Medicare would. Now, you could certainly argue it might have an economic impact. It might affect jobs. But for most Americans could not tell you, how many fighter planes we're going to build this year versus how many we need. But there is the thing that often tips the debate is the companies for whom it makes a great deal of difference whether we build 30 fighter planes or 40 fighter planes or 400 fighter planes, right? So the idea of kind of one person, one vote is completely distorted here. Most people couldn't care less and don't know, but a tiny, tiny minority, i.e. the military-industrial complex, gets to make the decisions because they're the ones who are going to reap the benefits. So concentrated benefits and diffused costs is not a good formula for a democratic outcome.
As we head into a break, I want to play another excerpt from the speech because it gets at this idea. One of the concerns that Eisenhower said, you write about, that the military-industrial complex being in balance, I suppose, can really distort the national economy. Here's another excerpt from the speech where he talks about that idea of, and I want to talk to you a little bit about this because he talks about, and we'll get to it after the break, but his sense of idealism and the importance of, I don't know if it's to say social programs, but certainly that when we're looking this way, the importance of social issues sort of fall by the wayside in some ways. Here's another excerpt from the speech, the farewell address of Dwight D. Eisenhower.
It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
Today in the program, we're talking about Dwight Eisenhower's speech with James Ledbetter. He's the author of the book Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. We will talk more when we get back after a break. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist James Ledbetter. We're talking about his book, Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. One of the cases against the military-industrial complex, you know, beyond the idea that it's, you know, creates this wasteful sense of military spending and it distorts the American economy, but that it takes away from spending on social needs. And I wanted to get your sense of whether this was something that Eisenhower worried about. Because one thing that emerges in your book is Eisenhower, who, you know, we think of him in this political era as this kind of benign, uncomplicated politician, but we see his idealistic side in this speech and in the way you write about him, which you say he would indulge this idealistic side as he became frustrated with those around him, his military subordinates, Democrats, the Soviets. Not everyone thought that his, you know, idealistic side was a great idea, but you write a little bit about that. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. This is a sort of rich vein to pursue, because I think in some ways, if you read through Eisenhower's public papers, what emerges is a sense of a highly idealistic person. If you contrast him, for example, with George W. Bush, whose memoir I've recently read, you know, Bush's ideals are pretty modest and his cynicism pretty high. Eisenhower, I think today a lot of what he said looks, I would say, almost shockingly naive in terms of its idealism, and therefore seems all the more sincere, right? Because you kind of think, like, he couldn't just be saying this for propaganda purposes because he looks, you know, kind of wimpy or naive.
This was in the height of the McCarthy era, mind you. That's the other thing to keep in mind.
That's right. But, you know, there's another speech that was given, as you think of these two speeches almost as the bookends of the Eisenhower presidency. Yeah. There was another speech given in April 1953, really the first major address that Eisenhower gave as president, which is known widely as the Chance for Peace speech, that really addresses this point. If you give me just a second, I'm just going to read a couple of sentences from it.
Yeah,
he said, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, Every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. It's stirring. It's stirring stuff. And I think, you know, in economics, we talk about opportunity costs. If you think about, you know, an economy is nothing more but nothing less than the sum total of what all of us produce. And if we are producing, you know, X percent of our GDP into stuff that either blows up or blows other stuff up, or at best case scenario, doesn't do anything at all but sits around and deters people from doing other things, that means it's coming out of what we might otherwise be doing, right? We might be devoting our money to better highways, to clothing the unclothed. We might be devoting our best scientific minds to innovation, to things that really drive an economy as opposed to stall it. And you get that same echo that you just quoted from in the farewell speech. And I think Eisenhower did believe these things. I do not think, you know, there is, of course, an element of propaganda during this period.
Sure.
The Chance for Peace speech was exquisitely timed because Stalin had just died, and there was a chance that the new leadership, they didn't know who was going to be running the Soviet Union in those early days. So there was sort of a chance that maybe they could get those people to sign on to a bit more of a cooperative agenda. But perhaps more importantly, in the kind of non-aligned nations, there was an opportunity to get more people on the American side. It didn't work. Khrushchev turned out to be just as implacable as Stalin, et cetera, et cetera. But there was an element of propaganda there. But I don't think Eisenhower would have said these things unless he really believed them. And I think evidence for this, again, toward the end of his presidency, before the speech was given, you see him in his letters, in some of his conversations with intimates, struggling to find some way out of the no-win logic of the Cold War. For example, he began to think about, could we have a plebiscite around the world where every single person would get to vote? Would you rather be governed by a communist society or a system of free enterprise? Now, wildly impractical? Yes. Probably meaningless? Yes. But I think it was a kind of a psychological fantasy that he had because it would help solve or untie these knots that weren't going to be untied any other way.
But James, let me just mention, before you move on, because that idea I think is intriguing when you think about the context or really the nature of the modern political conservative. If you think about, Eisenhower was a bona fide conservative of his day. There's no doubt about it. He was influenced by other kinds of ideas, and I want to get to Norman Cousins in a moment because that in of itself is kind of extraordinary. But if you think about, that is what ultra-conservatives said at another time. That is a new world order, which makes me wonder, where would Dwight Eisenhower fit in the modern conservative movement? And does it give you a sense of where conservatives, how they have evolved? Does that make sense?
This is a great question. If you could sort of reproduce the Dwight Eisenhower of 1961 in a room today, I think he would have next to no place in the American conservative movement, or frankly any place within the modern Republican Party. He represents a wing of the Republican Party, a kind of Republican thinking that simply has ceased to exist. There are, of course, strands between then and now.
Sure.
He was a genuine believer in a balanced budget, not someone who paid lip service to it. This is a president who actually submitted a budget to Congress that spent less money in the year he submitted it than the previous year, and he did it twice. No other president since has done it. He was a genuine believer in free enterprise. He was a genuine believer in the importance of the military. But I think that his honesty and his belief in the limits, in the need to put limits even on the things that you revere, makes him something of an outlier in the contemporary political context for either party, but particularly in the Republican Party. And that shift, Well, the shift starts with Nixon, who was his vice president, yeah. And when he ran for office in 1960, he had the platform of the Republican Party changed. When Eisenhower ran, there was a platform plank that said, you know, there has to be some kind of limit to what we're willing to spend to, you know, fight the Cold War, and both the Republicans and the Democrats by 1960 had said no limit, blank check, spend whatever it takes. You know, Kennedy says in his inaugural, bear any burden, pay any price. Eisenhower would have none of that. Mm. And then the second big thrust that changes it is Ronald Reagan. Where you begin to see the development of balanced budget as a rhetorical tool rather than a policy tool. Reagan, you know, preached the virtues of a balanced budget while running up what were then record deficits. Eisenhower would never have done that. And then there's the Vietnam War in there too. But I think, you know, Nixon and Reagan really changed the face of modern conservatism into something that Eisenhower would have been in many ways very uncomfortable with.
You know, what was so intriguing is the possible influence of the liberal editor and journalist Norman Cousins on just giving the speech in the first place. I mean, there's some sense that he may have suggested, Mr. President, it's a good idea to give this sort of final speech, just give some sort of wrapping up ideas. You talk about that the thinking, a lot of his thinking came from this correspondence he had with Norman Cousins, which seems surprising. The military.
It is surprising.
And the complexities, the way he felt of nuclear weapons came into play there as well.
That's right. I mean, Norman Cousins, for those who don't know, was the longtime editor of the Saturday Review magazine, which I guess if you had to put it in today's terms, was a weekly, shorter version of the Atlantic, but with a much more of a kind of agenda to it. Mm. It was thoughtful and lengthy journalism, but there was usually a cause attached to it. And Cousins was very much a man of causes. One of the things that he organized in the 50s and 60s was a campaign to get Americans to adopt children on whom the Hiroshima bombs were dropped. Mm-hmm. So dozens of Americans would bring, they were called the Hiroshima Maidens, and there was this whole campaign to adopt a girl and have her live with you, and because they were horribly disfigured by the atomic bomb and the kind of reconstructive surgery that would allow them to look something approaching normal was of course only available in the United States. This was a major campaign of his. He was also a big campaigner against the effects of nuclear testing and the radiation that put into our systems and all the nasty chemicals, and then went on. I mean, Cousins is a fascinating figure, deserves a book unto himself. But yeah. One of the complexities that I encountered in researching this book is there is this multi-year correspondence between Cousins and Eisenhower, mostly friendly, occasionally contentious, but there is no question that on, and Cousins was one of the founders of SANE, the Coalition of a Sane Nuclear Policy, sort of basically a disarmament group. And while, of course, you know, he was taking that position while the Eisenhower administration was building two nuclear bombs every single day, yeah. Wrap your head around that, he nonetheless had demonstrable impact on the way that Eisenhower was trying to envision a non-nuclear future. You have to keep in mind, in these early days of the Cold War, 53, 54, nobody really knew how it was going to play out. Mm. I alluded earlier to, you know, well, what if Stalin dies? Yeah. You know, well, that could create a thaw. What if we are able to get the United Nations or some United Nations-like body to take all the nuclear weapons and hide them from everybody, which was kind of what was done for chemical weapons for several decades. Eisenhower had that idea bouncing around in his head. So he was willing to allow idealism to inform and kind of float through his policies, even while, of course, his administration was carrying out policies that I think most people would say were the exact opposite of that idealism. And you get that sense in the final speech of, you know, a little bit like, I have failed you. You know, I have not been able to do all the things I wanted to do, but at least I didn't create a new war.
But this is what's so great about this point you make in the book. You say that Eisenhower was contradictory.
Yeah.
Because humans are contradictory. So don't try to understand it or explain it all. It's complicated.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, again, there are different interpretations. And you could say he's a hypocrite. Some historians and rhetoricians have said that you know, he essentially created a rhetoric of contradiction because that was the only way to kind of paper over the different things that were going on. But I genuinely believe that in these early days, no one had a firm, unchangeable idea of what we should do with nuclear weapons now that we had them, and that Eisenhower's belief about them and their relationship to society evolved over time, which is what you'd want in a leader.
Let me ask you this finally, because it's interesting. One of the big questions is just exactly what did Eisenhower really have in mind in terms of, you know, the role for a military? Because he believed in large arsenals. He believed in a standing army as being important at times. So you ask, how did he think the country would avoid a military-industrial complex? We only have about a minute left, but give us some sense of that.
Well, the speech is short on solutions.
Yeah.
The kind of cop-out solution, but I think, you know, a viable one, is an informed and knowledgeable citizenry.
Right.
That old Jeffersonian idea of eternal vigilance being the price of liberty is something that he believed in and tried to apply in this situation. I think that he would have applauded the strategic arms treaties that really began in earnest after he left office, and negotiating with your enemies to sort of at least limit our use of these weapons. And I think he was finally a believer in accountability, and he wanted to see the military subject to as much accountability as other parts of the society.
This is James Ledbetter. He's the editor of Reuters.com. His book is called Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. James, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.